coming to you from sunny Los Angeles, California. This is 30 Minute Mentors. Leaders to listen to with Adam Mendler. Here is your host, Adam Mendler.
I am excited to have an entrepreneur who not only co-founded a billion-dollar company, but disrupted an entire industry. And it's one of the most popular industries in America, and an industry that I personally loved as a kid. I'm sure many of our listeners very actively engage in. Tom Griffiths pioneered the daily fantasy sports category as co-founder and chief product officer of FanDuel, literally working with his partners to transform an idea into a billion-dollar business with more than 6 million active users. More recently, Tom co-founded Hone, an innovative leadership development platform where he serves as the CEO. Tom, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Adam. Really thrilled to be here.
Thrilled to have you on. First question for you is a really important one. How often do your friends ask you for gambling advice?
It's a great question, right? I think it's funny because, you know, we were all so passionate about building FanDuel as a business. We often didn't get time to do the research that we would need to actually be really good and competitive at the game. You know, whereas we were spending all our waking hours kind of building the platform and building the team, it turns out that when we played with friends, we were actually the worst when it came to fantasy. So not that often, I guess, is the short answer.
That's funny. So go, if you can, go all the way back to those early days as the co-founder of FanDuel. How did it come about? How did FanDuel get started? Where did the idea come from? Really take us back to the very beginning.
Yeah, absolutely. So we were in the UK. It was a group of us, five founders. We were holed up in a kind of small, almost like a tiny office or classroom at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland, where it's cold and dark and rainy, and you know, tend to spend a lot of time indoors programming computers or trying to come up with the next biggest startup idea to kind of to get the hell out of there. And I think, you know, I'd left my PhD because I was just so excited about the world of startups and what was possible with, you know, the skill set that I had from a kind of computer science background to build something that lots of people would use. And I thought that's all it took to start an internet company was kind of enthusiasm, the ability to program, and like a big idea that, you know, you thought had to be a reality. And by the time things rolled around to FanDuel, we were on our third idea, first two really not having worked out. And so I wouldn't say, you know, we were desperate, but we were kind of desperate trying to think of something that would work because, you know, I'd been this good student and I dropped out to build an internet company and we needed something that would work. And so FanDuel was actually a pivot from an earlier idea called HubDub, which was a site where folks would predict the outcomes of news stories. And what we'd seen there was that there was a ton of engagement around predicting sports, but there wasn't so much engagement around predicting other things that we really wanted people to be predicting on news stories like politics and world news and entertainment. So we figured, why not double down on sports, focus the product on that, find a way to monetize, which led us to the kind of fantasy sports framework, and actually, you know, got started with FanDuel as a short form fantasy sports site in that way. So rather than it be kind of like an inspiration in the middle of the night, it was really quite a exploratory, iterative process to get to a sports site that and went on to become FanDuel.
When did you realize that you had it? What was that aha moment?
That's a great question. There are a couple. I think, you know, given that we've kind of been wandering in the wilderness a little bit, looking for this impactful idea that we could come up with and tried a few things that hadn't really landed, the earliest signs that we had that people loved it were when we were prototyping the idea right in the first few weeks. So we would build, you know, different game formats. Actually, before writing a line of code, we put it into a Google spreadsheet and we advertised it on Craigslist and we had people send us money over PayPal. So we really taken a super lean approach to testing concepts. And when people were sending us money without even a website being there to run this new game format that we'd come up with, it really felt like we were onto something. Of course, we'd call them up and ask them what they thought. And, you know, they wanted us to make it forever increasing price points. So we were like, okay, there's definitely something here. So that was a kind of a super exciting early proof point.
I guess on the other side of the coin, you mentioned a buzzword that as an entrepreneur has to be top of mind, which is pivot. Mm-hmm. When did you realize that you had to pivot? And what is your advice to, this is a two-part question. Part one is, when did you realize that you had to pivot? And part two is, what is your advice for listeners who are entrepreneurs as to when they should start thinking about the right time to pivot in their businesses?
Yeah, great questions. I think for us with HubDub, we were seeing engagement. So, you know, engagement metrics were good. I think what we were struggling with was the growth economics of the business. So the fact that it was a free game meant that we needed free user acquisition. And of course, that's challenging the best of times. What we were really seeking was some kind of viral loop that would allow us to bring in users at, you know, low or free cost. And that wasn't happening. And so it felt like even though we had this kind of gratification engine that we'd built, there wasn't a clear path to growth. And having exhausted a few creative ideas there, you know, partnerships and promotions and viral tuning, it wasn't going to work. So it was time to like look at what were the bright spots within our data, where was the kind of white hot center of activity that matched with the kind of growth strategy. And for us, that was sports, because we knew we could monetize that within a fantasy sports framework. So I would say, you know, the more general point of like, when is the right time to pivot is a hard one, because you don't want to be too prone to pivoting. You need perseverance. One of our investors at Hone, Michael Deering, says it best when he says, you know, when you encounter an obstacle, you need to figure out whether that wall is made of paper or made of 6-foot concrete.
Yeah.
So you can't just turn around right away. You've got to punch your way through it for a while, but you know, you've got to use your judgment when there's, you know, you've tried your creative ideas, there's diminishing returns on whatever strategy might be around product or growth, and it's time to try something new. I would say that, you know, it was never a blind pivot for us where we turn 90 degrees left one day and forget everything that we did before. We actually ran the two sites in parallel, I think, for nearly up to 12 months, where we were testing FanDuel to see that it was going to work out before, you know, really jumping over. And I think, you know, our CEO, Nigel, kind of led us right there, which was as soon as we saw the signs were working, you know, let's burn the boats and really go for it, because you don't want to kind of be in two camps. But I think the turning point for us was when we'd seen that FanDuel had made more revenue in the first month than HubDub had in the first 18 months, we knew that that was going to be a much more promising avenue for us.
Can you talk about, from your experience running FanDuel, how entrepreneurs can scale their business? How do you go from an idea that's proven, there's some traction, to the kind of success that you've been able to enjoy?
I think there are a few elements to that question. I think, you know, you've got to find that growth engine that drives the growth of the business, and then you've got to be able to keep up with that operationally as you grow the team and continue to execute well, and then figure out what, you know, second and third acts are going to be. For us, and for many companies, and rightly so, you know, the driving engine of growth for us was strong unit economics. So we knew exactly how to acquire users, how much we would need to spend to do that, and how we would make, how quickly we could make that acquisition cost back to then recycle that. So if anyone watched sports in 2015 or 16, you know, they will have seen carpet bombing the FanDuel and DraftKings ads. And, you know, that's the kind of unfortunate outcome of hyper-analytical marketing, knowing exactly how to acquire users, because even though it made people's eyes bleed by the end of the football season, we were still really profitable in kind of growing users that way. And so, you know, we found our marketing channels. We knew exactly how much it cost to acquire someone. And we were scaling that as aggressively as we could. So that was kind of the engine for driving the business. And then, you know, the second part I would say is, how do you keep up with that? And I think, you know, as an entrepreneur, as a leader, you really go through several different growth stages or acts as a business and as a leader to figure out, you know, what I was doing at this stage is not what I need to be focused on at the next stage. So, you know, at the early stages, it's really about all hands on deck to figure out this product market fit and what's the growth engine going to be. And then it's scaling the team, codifying, you know, what does it mean to be FanDuel culture? What does it mean for the ways that we kind of want to work together? What are the kind of people that we want to bring into the organization? And how are we going to construct a team structure that plays to everybody's strengths today, but also scales for tomorrow? So there's a lot of just like operational management and company building that goes behind that growth driver.
Who are the kinds of people that you want to bring into a successful organization? What are the skills that, or the features or the characteristics that are most important to building a winning organizational culture, in your view?
I think this is a great question. I think my viewpoint on this has changed over the years. I think I used to put a lot more emphasis on skills and experience in the early days. And over the years, I've realized that what's really important is raw ability, both to kind of be a smart problem solver and get things done, coupled with the right kind of values and mindset to want to be part of the company and the story that you're building. If you've got those things in place, then, you know, for most roles, you can trade off a little bit on the experience and resume side, because things change so quickly in a growing company that the folks who can learn and adapt the fastest with the most commitment and the most passion for what you're doing are the people that you want in the boat with you, as opposed to folks that are perhaps more experienced but less kind of committed to the cause and less adaptable over time.
What are some of the things that you learned early on in your career? Could be hard skills, could be important life lessons that have really shaped who you are today as a leader, as an entrepreneur, and just as a person?
I think a theme that's come out a few times for me is, you know, when you graduate in school, you know, you're taught that your job is to have the right answer. And the way that you progress to the top is to be the person always knowing what to do or what the right answer is. And I think that often early in your career, perhaps that's what you think you're meant to be doing. You are meant to be the person with all the answers. And if you're not, then, you know, there's some insecurity around that and you want to cover it up or, you know, pretend that you do know. I think true next level leadership is recognizing that you're not the expert in every area. And really what you should be doing is surrounding yourself with people that can do things better than you can and have the self-confidence to align that team around the goal and where you're going, and you know, have the people skills to bring that team together and achieve that outcome and not be the one necessarily knowing all the answers. I think that also flows into, you know, first seeking to listen and understand the folks that you're working with rather than trying to be the one telling them what to do, because you know that's the way that you get leverage out of people. So I think there's been a constant theme for me of leaning back rather than leaning forward, looking to others for the answers, providing and setting the direction, as opposed to trying to be, you know, a straight A student that knows all the right things to do.
I love that, Tom. I mean, I couldn't agree more and I couldn't say it better myself. You and I are both very, very passionate about the subject of leadership. We both spend a lot of time personally and professionally thinking about it, working on it. Tell our listeners about Hone, why you started it, what it's about, what you're focused on.
So, I mean, as we've been talking about, I completely agree. You know, think a lot about leadership and management and the FanDuel growth experience, growing it from five of us in that kind of rainy, cold classroom environment in Scotland to, you know, 500 folks across seven different offices in a few short years, really was, you know, a baptism of fire for me, learning leadership and management on the job. And what I saw was that both in myself and my ability to kind of get up that learning curve, and for our, you know, dozens and dozens of managers across the a couple of continents, it was hard to find the right learning experiences for us that really fit the way that we work today. A lot of leadership training is either let's fly everybody to a single location and sit in the classroom for a couple of days while our inboxes fill up and, you know, while I'm thinking about what's for dinner. And then I'm left on my own to go back to my desk and be this great leader now that I've had this experience, which isn't great and it's super inconvenient and expensive. Or, you know, there's a bunch of pre-recorded videos online, whether that's LinkedIn Learning or Skillshare, Skillsoft, where I can watch a video about how to be a great leader. And really, that's only part of the learning experience. But it's convenient, it's scalable, you can use it on your own time. And so what we saw as a gap in the market was, how can we take the best of both worlds, where we have live interactive training and, you know, the transformational experiences that you can create there, and couple that with the scalability of e-learning so that you can scale it to a global team and measure its effectiveness. And so that's what Hone is. I left FanDuel after 10 years with that company, really to pursue a passion in education and leadership to create this next generation platform that lets organizations scale live leadership in just 60-minute Zoom-based sessions to their global employee population so that we can create more access for people everywhere to great leadership training.
Tom, what can anyone do to become a better leader?
There's three components that stand out when you look at various breakdowns of leadership. I think there's the first one is, setting a vision. If leadership is working with people to make a vision a reality, first of all, you've got to have the vision. You've got to know where you're going. The second is you've got to have the capability so that people trust that you know what you're doing and will follow you because you're going to get them through the forest or know how to get up the mountain. And then the third is that you've got to really connect with the people that you're asking to come with you so that they feel like you've got the mission or the team's interests at or above your own interests and so that they feel really cared for. And I would summarize those three things in the words of Jim Mattis, who was a four-star general with the United States Marine Corps, where he boils it down beautifully into the three C's of competence, caring, and conviction. So conviction around vision, competence, and the caring for the team. And so if that's what leadership is, I guess, how do you get people there? What we teach at Hone is that really your behaviors are a function of your mindsets. And so if you can get the right mindset or leadership mindset in that you understand those three components, you believe that there's a leader inside you, there's not one form of leadership. The most effective leader that you can be is going to be the one that's authentic to who you are. And so think through how you can manifest those three C's, then that is the right mindset to then think through what the downstream behaviors might be. And we can go into what you actually have to do as a leader, but I think it does start with knowing what leadership is and having the mindset that you can get there.
Experience Adam's insights and inspirational message by booking Adam to appear at your company, on your campus, or at your next event. Adam's keynotes and workshops on leading in today's landscape, becoming your best self, and lessons learned from America's top leaders leave audiences inspired and better equipped to excel personally and professionally. Visit adammendler.com to learn more and to bring Adam to your organization.
How did you get to this point? What were some of the downs that you were able to turn into ups?
Absolutely. I mean, one period comes to mind very clearly as you asked that. I mean, and it wasn't the early days of FanDuel. That was kind of a time of creation and excitement about what we could build. The darkest days, I would say, on that journey were in late 2015, 2016, once we thought we'd made it, created this billion-dollar company. All our hard work for the previous 8 years was kind of being validated, and we thought we were there. And then through a few events led to the industry hitting this kind of downward spiral, very publicly, with kind of front page New York Times investigations, FBI scrutiny, really because of the fact that we had created a money-based game around real life sports that was a fantasy sports game, but because of the short timescales, kind of invited that scrutiny once we got to that scale. And so that really, decimated our business and our morale as, the investigations came and the, the regulatory environment changed. And, for a period there, state by state, day by day, there were, half our market got shut down because of attorneys general really kind of deciding to pause our operations and investigate us a bit more. So, we've come through the other side stronger now, and FanDuel's a thriving business in the new kind of legal environment that actually has changed as a result of the fight back that we mounted to the kind of misplaced kind of regulatory scrutiny or legal challenges. But you can imagine, as an entrepreneur that's kind of traveled from that kind of small time Scotland to big time New York over a period of 8 years of hard graft, to have your kind of vision decimated over a period of weeks was just emotionally destroying. And so, there were a ton of lessons that I learned in those times for sure.
Do you mind diving into some of those lessons?
Yeah, I mean, I think the one that comes through the most was a quote from Tony Robbins, which says that leaders have to see things how they are, but not worse than they are. And I think when you've got a company of people that you know, most of whom have joined in the last 6 months thinking they're on a rocket ship. And, you know, suddenly we're the opposite of that. A lot of heads go down. And so as leaders, you know, you've really got to not paint a land of milk and honey and pretend that things are great, but actually not also indulge in the, you know, the downward spiral and the over negativity that can occur. There's a concept called the Stockdale paradox. After a prisoner of war, Admiral Stockdale in the Vietnam War. And it shows that, I mean, his lesson was that the folks in the concentration camps were the ones that didn't make it, were certainly the ones that gave up, but also the ones that had false hope. You really had to balance ultimate belief that you'll get through this with the reality that it's really hard right now. And so I think we had to toe a fine line there as leaders to make sure that people knew that we recognize the severity of the situation, but weren't going to see it as overly negative and reassure people we were going to get through, which we did.
Can you talk about the importance of mental health as a leader and how you prioritize it and what kind of exercises others can do to build just a winning mindset?
I think it's absolutely crucial. Like I said before, at Hone, you know, our teaching starts with this idea that mindset leads to behaviors, behaviors lead to results. And if you're not seeing the results that you want, then oftentimes people go to the behaviors, but really you need to go deeper and go back to the mindsets. And so having a healthy mind and cultivating that over your entire career will return volumes in terms of the behaviors and results that you get. I would say that, you know, as you go up the organization as a leader and as your organization grows underneath you, the smallest things get amplified as they cascade down the organization. So I can remember having to learn to be really careful what I said about our product because, you know, three layers down, people are going to perceive that as Tom has absolutely said that this button is going to be blue when I might have said, hey, are there any other colors that we might want to look at? And so that goes for your demeanor as well. You know, if people see you walking around with a, you know, frown on your face or kind of a hunched shoulders, then they're going to pick up on that and amplify it. So I think in maintaining your own emotions in check and your own mindsets in check will have the effect in the opposite direction, which is, you know, you can set an example and be a role model for everybody to take a positive mindset and productive kind of approach to work.
Can you talk about the people you surround yourself with and specifically using FanDuel as a case study? That founding team of FanDuel, why it was so successful and the complementary pieces and what listeners can learn from it.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, we were five founders at FanDuel, which is a lot. There was Nigel Eccles, who is the CEO, myself as a head of product, Leslie Eccles as head of marketing, Rob Jones, head of design, and then Chris Stafford as head of technology. And so from a job title perspective and a skill set perspective, as you can tell, it was quite a good mix. Like we had the right combination of skill sets in the founding team that helped us get quite far, actually, just the five of us. What really bound us together, though, and I think made us successful was less about the skill sets. And as I said earlier, it was about the way that we solved problems together, the fact that we didn't give up, even in the face of that original pivot, and then some of the growth challenges with FanDuel in the first few years and then ultimately in the kind of crisis period kind of legal challenge period. We just didn't give up. And whenever there was, I guess, trouble in the team or the company more broadly, it would always be the founders who would come back together and support each other to go back out there and, you know, solve the problem and keep the team moving forward and focus on, you know, a positive outcome. So I think more than anything else, just that camaraderie, that tenacity, that shared purpose to work together to create something that had really been forged at the early stage and continued for a decade was what made it such a special team to be a part of.
Tom, I'm going to ask you some rapid fire questions in our remaining time.
Let's do it.
What was the FanDuel's relationship with DraftKings from the early days?
Oh, we hated each other. I mean, that's the short answer, and, you know, tongue in cheek, because we actually got to know each other quite well through an ultimately ill-fated merger where I spent 11 months of my life trying to bring the two arch rivals together. And then ultimately, you know, the FTC in its infinite wisdom decided that we shouldn't merged and we had to go back to being arch rivals. But, you know, the group of folks at the heart of DraftKings are very similar to us in that they were, you know, scrappy entrepreneurs that wanted nothing more than their company to succeed. And so I respect them for that. But, you know, as gentlemen competitors, we really, you know, were at fierce odds with each other at every step of the way. And so, you know, it was a healthy competition.
How did you differentiate your product from DraftKings product? I mean, you were the chief product officer.
Yeah, I mean, they were very similar products. I mean, truth be told, I think, you know, where we focused as a differentiator was that our product was and is a very welcoming experience to more casual fans, and DraftKings tended to capture more of the high-end shark-like customers. So we were proud of that.
Best advice around differentiation?
Make it defensible. It can't just be fleeting in your mind or easily copyable. I think that's one of the things that we suffered from in daily fantasy sports. It was kind of very tit for tat. So read the Seven Powers book on how to create defensible competitive advantage.
What was your data analytics operations like?
Actually pretty sophisticated. I mean, there's a lot of data and we used it to create a better product experience and grow the business. So we had data analysts embedded on every team and a great infrastructure to help us do it.
What should listeners learn about data analytics?
How to tell a story around data and not just present a bunch of numbers or boil the ocean. I think start with a hypothesis, then try and validate or invalidate that through your research as opposed to just browsing endless reams of data.
Easiest way to describe your relationships with state and federal regulators?
I can't speak to it more recently, given I've been out of the business for a couple of years. But at that point, you know, we recognized that we needed to work together to find the right regulatory framework for our customers and for our industry as it grows. So it was pretty positive through all the work we did together.
Relationship with the professional sports leagues?
Again, very positive. I think that, you know, it was symbiotic. We needed them to be flourishing for our product to make sense. And in fact, you know, as they saw dynamics in their viewership, fantasy and particularly daily fantasy was a way to drive further engagement with sports. And so they really appreciated what we did. And of course, you know, the NBA was a long-term investor in FanDuel. And so we were very close.
What's the future of sports gambling?
I think, you know, we're seeing slowly state by state legislation to allow it. I think in the land of the free, people should be able to do that. And I think that with smart regulation and responsible products, that it can be a great entertainment experience for more and more people.
Best advice for entrepreneurs who are listening, who also want to build the next billion-dollar business?
I would say for me, I mean, FanDuel was a great experience. What I'm really enjoying with Hone is that it's as much a passion project as it is, you know, a multi-billion-dollar business, we hope, one day. And so it's cliche, but, you know, find something that you're super passionate about and can see yourself doing for the next 10 years, because, you know, the chances of having a quick hit are really low. This is a long-term profession.
Best way to build a culture that fuels disruption and innovation?
Always, when you're building culture, it's leading by example. And so as the CEO or founder, kind of questioning assumptions, pushing the team to do more, and having a tolerance for failure, there's nothing that shuts down innovation more than a leader who shoots people down for trying something and failing. As soon as people see you do that, they clam up and don't experiment. So, you know, celebrate failure, celebrate innovation, and be the first to kind of question the core assumptions.
What are the biggest misconceptions that people have about success?
There's a point at which it feels like you have success. I think just the world we live in is there's always more to do. There's more to achieve. There's more impact to have. And so, you know, when you really dig in to hear from the most quote unquote successful people, they're generally thinking about what's ahead, other than, you know, they've made it. So pick something that you like and enjoy the journey, because there's never really an end.
So what did you do along the way that others didn't do?
I think when it comes to FanDuel, I think it was a few things. I mean, we really focused on what the customer wanted as opposed to what we wanted. Oftentimes it's easy to be in love with your own ideas. And so we were pretty ruthless about culling the stuff that didn't work. And then just like stay in the game. It's easy to give up when you have to, you know, stare down the barrel of that fundraise that's going to take, you know, 80 to 100 investor pitches. Should I go and get that kind of corporate job and take it easy for a few years? we didn't because we didn't have another option. We just stayed in the game, and that's, you know, if you can stay in long enough, then you'll find a way to make it successful.
What was the biggest risk you ever taken in your career?
I think,
and I'm just going to cut you off as you think about the answer and point out to listeners that all of the things that Tom spent duration of this episode talking about, he didn't consider big risks. So I think that's a really interesting point that most of us would say, wow, Tom took all these huge risks and he doesn't even consider any of those risks. But go ahead.
Yeah, some people would call that deluded. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it has to be the pivot to FanDuel from HubDub. I think because it was like third shot, I'd quit my PhD, I'd quit a previous company, GroupIt. We were pivoting from HubDub to do an American sports company in an area that none of us had a ton of experience. It was pretty crazy when you look back at it. So that was probably the biggest risk, but after several years of hard work, it paid off.
How do you motivate yourself on days you don't feel motivated?
I think, again, as a leader, you come to work, people look at your emotional state. And so you got to show up for them and make sure that they see that every day you're setting the standard for commitment and hard work and ambition. So it's not really an option to not do that when you've got a team around you.
How important, in your view, on a scale of 1 to 10, is ethics to leadership and why?
It's an easy 10, I think. I got to experience an industry in turmoil with FanDuel, and I think that really tests people's values and ethics. I'm proud to say that the FanDuel team always had the highest standard of ethics and always did the right thing. One of our core values was trust, with its associated behavior being do the right thing even when no one's watching. And that allowed us to stand up to scrutiny when it came. And so I think, you know, the when no one's watching part is the really important part of that. So it might feel like you can cut corners some days when, you know, it's not in full view, but it'll come back to bite you if you do. So do the right thing even when no one's watching.
Single best piece of advice. What can anyone, and you actually, Tom, you don't need to limit it to one because I know you have a lot of value. How can any listener become more successful? Period.
I think the Tony Robbins ultimate success formula, for whatever you think of that packaging, is the one that stands out for me. It's get really clear on what you want and where you want to be. Take huge action towards moving towards it, and then evaluate and reflect regularly to see, am I making the progress that I want to? And if so, double down. If not, take a different approach and just keep taking a different approach until you ultimately get where you want to be. I think when you hear that, it can sometimes feel a bit like, you know, I want the house, I want the money, and want the car. And as I've got older, I think for me, my goals are more around the kind of person I want to be rather than the things I want to have. Like, I want to be someone that people see as a great leader, someone that they want to work with, work for, someone that's setting an example for how companies can have a positive impact on society, rather than the kind of material goods that go with traditional pictures of success. That's just for me. But I think the idea of getting clear and then moving and constantly reflecting is the right way to go about it.
Tom, thank you for joining us. Thank you for sharing such incredible wisdom and insight. We really appreciate it.
Adam, thanks for having me. It's been a great discussion. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to 30 Minute Mentors. If you enjoyed the podcast, spread the word and feel free to tag Adam at Adam Mendler. You can also head to adammendler.com for more episodes and to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. And don't forget to join us next week for another episode with another one of our 30 Minute Mentors.